Inside Florida Politics, powered by Gannett. Hello, I'm Sarasota Herald Tribune political editor Zach Anderson, and I'm joined as always by Gannett State Capitol reporter John Kennedy. Hey, John.
Hello, Zach.
And returning to the show this week after a long absence is our great colleague at the Palm Beach Post politics editor Antonio Finns. Hey, Antonio, welcome back.
Hey, gentlemen, glad to be back on the air.
Oh, we're excited to have you back on the show. Well, here in Florida, we like to think we are the absolute undisputed champion of screwing up elections, but Iowa tried to challenge our title this week. Antonio is going to give us his thoughts on the caucus calamity and what it means for Florida's primary next month. Meanwhile, we're reaching the midway point of Florida's 60-day legislative session. John has the scoop on what's happening with some of the big issues like abortion and teacher pay. And I sat down with Florida's new chief science officer. I'll tell you what he had to say about climate change. But first, you all know what that music means. It's number picking time. Antonio, we might not have all the numbers out of Iowa yet, but I know you came prepared with a number, right?
I do. 0.2%.
0.2. All right. I don't think anybody's going to get below you on that one this week unless I'm utterly surprised here. You like to go low. John, how about you?
Yeah, Zach, you hear a lot about being number one, right? Well, how about two? And that's my number this week, a simple two.
Yeah, we're number two is not as good of a chant, but I'll give you that one. A simple two, John. All right, I'm going to blow it out of the water here with 145,000. So that's 0.2% for Antonio, 2 for John, 145,000 for me. Remember those numbers. Write them down. We'll tell you what they mean in Florida politics after the show. Well, the biggest winner out of Iowa this week may have been Florida election administrators, who can now point to their counterparts in corn country as the poster children for electoral incompetence. Florida Democrats might also benefit. The caucus meltdown meant that Iowa didn't give candidates the big bounce they might normally get from a solid performance in that state. The longer this race remains competitive, the more likely that Florida's March 17th primary could prove consequential, right, Antonio?
Absolutely. And I think, first of all, got to be so happy that Florida election officials have basically bypassed the idea of doing a caucus driven by an app. I think we should all thank them. One big thank you, one big basket of oranges we should send up to Tallahassee for, you know, not going that route. But you're absolutely right. I think that the fact of the matter is that in the past, election cycles, the primary seasons, Florida has sort of been at the tail end, and we haven't really been decisive. I think, you know, if you go back, the last time that this state was proved pivotal in deciding a nominee was back in 2008, and that was the Republican primary. John McCain was in a big battle with Mitt Romney. They came to Florida. Charlie Crist, who was the governor at that time, a Republican at that time as well, endorsed McCain, and then McCain won Florida, and that gave them momentum to go the way through.
That was a big deal. I mean, Chris' endorsement at the time was seen as a real coup. I think he was angling to get the vice presidential nomination there. And in 2016, you had Clinton and Sanders and Trump and Rubio, but Clinton and Trump had pretty big leads coming in, right?
They did. This state was not competitive, even though going into 2016, you had two Florida favorite sons in both Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio. Jeb flamed out well before he got to Florida, and then Trump trounced Rubio in the primary. So this time around, you know, what you see out of Iowa is a couple of things. Number one, because of the debacle, whoever ends up being declared the winner, and we assume that it's going to be declared soon, that winner will not have gotten the bump or the momentum that you generally do get from that election night victory statement and that speech that all the networks focus on.
Right.
And then the other thing, too, is that the two people who look like they're, well, I think we can pretty much conclude that one of them will be the winner, which is South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg and Vermont U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders. Both of those guys have shown a real ability to raise money and a lot of money. And the thing about Florida is that this is a money state. This is not an Iowa or New Hampshire where you go to cafes outside the Versailles restaurant in Little Havana, you know, to get a little Cuban coffee. Don't really do that kind of campaign. It's really money, advertising, and that's the big factor. Both of them are really prepared to be, you know, who have shown that they've both shown that they can raise a lot of money. So they're going to have, you know, a shot here at Florida. The other thing is that in Iowa, it looks like no matter how this turns out, Joe Biden did really poorly. And right. Biden has been atop the Florida polls and by wide margins from the start. And if you remove Joe Biden from the equation, and I'm not suggesting that's the case, this is still a long way to go before we get to Florida. But if you put those large numbers of voters in play, then you know it's a field for both Buttigieg, Sanders, and whoever is left in the race, and Mike Bloomberg now factors sure. big time.
Bloomberg is sort of waiting here, waiting for all these candidates to get out of the early states, and he's invested a ton of money in Florida, right?
Oh, he has. He has spent a mint already in advertising in this state, and he's already opened offices in St. Pete and Orlando. This week, he's opening an office here in West Palm Beach. So he now becomes a major player. You know, he skipped Iowa. He's skipping New Hampshire, although he will be apparently on the debate stage tomorrow on Friday night. You know, in New Hampshire, but he's basically skipped those states, and he's really been playing the Super Tuesday and beyond card. And again, the Iowa debacle plus Joe Biden's poor showing puts him in play in Florida and elsewhere.
Yeah, and you know, Bloomberg, you know, his bet or his only play here, because he didn't get in early enough to compete in the early states, was that nobody would come out of those early states strong enough, and that his money and you know, his ability to organize and have the resources would overwhelm whoever comes out of that early state, or that it would be so muddled that you know, he can get in there and be competitive. And Iowa is you know, showing that maybe that could be a possibility. You know, when you don't get that bump out of Iowa, I mean, usually I saw one political analyst say that often Iowa is sort of like a freight train. Once you get that momentum, you know, you can ride that. And really the with the caucus calamity, it's sort of the train never really left the station there. And, you know, you don't have that momentum. And then if you have, you know, Buttigieg, I mean, that was a big win for him for being a relatively, you know, unknown, you know, kind of somebody who didn't have a big national profile until this last year. For him, you know, that was a win that maybe could have vaulted him into contention in some of these other states. But it looks like he's not going to get that kind of momentum out of this that he might have. And then if you have somebody else win New Hampshire, if you have Biden maybe win South Carolina, the race could be pretty muddled when it gets to Florida, don't you think?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the interesting thing, I mean, we've been trashing Iowa, but the fact that Buttigieg did so well does speak to what the strength of Iowa has always been, this retail politics, this man on the street and woman in the street politics approach. And clearly he did very well in that. Although, like I said before, he does have shown a real ability to raise a lot of money, but it shows that that translates into being able to appeal to the voters on the street. You know, the thing about New Hampshire, which usually whoever leaves Iowa with a lot of momentum goes into New Hampshire and then all eyes on New Hampshire, is that's New Hampshire this year is not going to be as pivotal or as determining as it has been in the past, largely because you've got Sanders and Warren, who are senators from nearby, you know, from border states to New Hampshire. So right. It's kind of seen as, yeah, OK, whoever wins there, if it's Sanders or Warren, although latest polls is she's not doing very well in New Hampshire, it was OK, but, you know, you were expected to do well in that state. So right. It really, all eyes will go to Nevada next. And that's where you're going to see the first real battleground, because Nevada is more of a money state. But still, you do get some of that retail politics. And the important thing about Nevada is it's the first state on the schedule that has a sizable minority population. Iowa and New Hampshire are both largely states that are pretty homogeneous, you know, mostly sure. a white electorate among Democrats and Republicans. So you get to Nevada, and that's the first state you see where the minority vote, particularly blacks and Hispanics, does start to weigh in. And then obviously, like you mentioned, South Carolina and the South, which the African-American vote figures prominently and will be the determining factor in many of those
yeah,
states.
Yeah, and you can't count Biden out, because he does really well with minority voters. So if he does well in Nevada in South Carolina, even though he had a horrible performance in Iowa that was sort of overshadowed by the caucus screw up. And so it wasn't as bad for him as it might have been in terms of the media coverage. And then if he gets a bounce back in Nevada or South Carolina, and he's still polling well in Florida, and Florida could help lift him back up. So we'll have to see. But it does seem like there is a better chance of Florida, having some influence on this race now after what we've seen in Iowa. Well, there was another big national news story this week that could reverberate here in Florida. President Trump was acquitted by the Senate in his impeachment trial. Florida's two U.S. senators, Marco Rubio and Rick Scott, voted to acquit. Other than Mitt Romney, Republicans were firmly behind Trump throughout this impeachment process, reflecting the strong support he has within the GOP base. There was a Gallup poll that came out recently that showed Trump's approval rating with Republicans is now 94%, up 6 points from their last survey. Antonio, impeachment seems to have only boosted Trump's support within his base. And I wonder if you think that bodes well for him in Florida. His strategy in 2016 really was to boost GOP turnout in counties that were already leaned Republican, and it was really effective. Do you think that impeachment could help him sort of replicate that?
Yeah, no question about it. I think if you look at their fundraising during the impeachment process, it increased. I mean, they were raising money left and right even before the impeachment inquiry began, and ultimately the articles were approved by the House, and then you had the trial. So it has really helped them. It has also helped coalesce the Republican base, which was already firmly behind him. So that's no surprise there. The interesting thing is it's going to be how this plays out in Florida in particular. You have two House seats in South Florida in the Miami area, the one that's occupied by Donna Shalala and the one occupied by Debbie Mercosell Powell. Both of them were all in on impeachment, particularly Mercosell Powell. Those are seats that were held by Republicans before. You got to believe that the Republican Congressional Campaign Committee is really going to zero in on those two seats to see if they can flip them in 2020 in November.
Right.
But there's no question though that this really, the impeachment, the way it played out, and you look at the way that particularly the U.S. House members from Florida in your area, Greg Stube, he really sure came out strong for Trump. Matt Gaetz was out there as well. A lot of Florida members of Congress really elevated their profiles during this impeachment process. And Val Demings, who was one of the House managers who prosecuted the case in the Senate and became a rising star in all of this. So, yes, absolutely, the impeachment, the Trump campaign is going to benefit from both fundraising and from the loyalty of Republicans. But also, you're going to see the way that a lot of our members of Congress in this state were elevated their profiles during the impeachment. It's going to be an interesting mix into the dynamics of the 2020 politics and the elections.
Yeah, 2016 was definitely a base election, and 2020 is shaping up to be the same type of thing. And anything that really rallies your base like this impeachment, I mean, nothing really fires up your supporters like when you have your back against the wall, you're defending yourself, and they think that you're being unjustly persecuted. So I definitely think that this could boost GOP enthusiasm. And if you look at the map of what how Trump won Florida in 2016, I mean, Hillary Clinton did actually better than Barack Obama in some of the big urban areas of Florida. But Trump put up numbers in some of the areas like this area, like Sarasota County, like Southwest Florida, Northeast Florida, the Panhandle, all of the suburbs around the urban areas. He just increased turnout amongst Republicans and Republican-leaning voters to a remarkable degree. I don't know how much more he could increase turnout than he did last time. I mean, it was a pretty big boost from what you saw with Mitt Romney in 2012, but it does seem like something like impeachment could help him continue to push that strategy. So, definitely could have big impacts here in Florida, the biggest battleground state. Well, Florida's election season is about to heat up, with the presidential primary being the first contest here. But before the primary arrives on March 17th, we have another month of political wrangling to keep an eye on in the Florida legislature. Florida's 60-day legislative session has now reached the halfway point, or is going to next week. John, there's a bunch of big issues that you've been tracking up there in Tallahassee, from teacher pay to a new abortion restriction and other hot button things like E-Verify. Where do we stand on all this stuff at the halfway point? No major bills have passed at this point, right?
Yeah, no big bills yet, but budgets have moved out of committees in the House and Senate, and that's a heavy lift and always a sign that the earliest part of the session's home stretch is about to begin. It's sort of the beginning of the end, and some real differences have emerged this year. The starters, the Senate spends $1.4 billion more in its $92.8 billion budget than the House does. So there's a matter to resolve. Governor Ron DeSantis is in his second year and maybe having a little bit more trouble keeping his Republican legislative allies in line. While both sides top DeSantis's call for $625 million to help with water cleanup and Everglades restoration, they're taking a different approach toward his other signature call, and that's for $600 million in teacher pay raises and another $300 million for a bonus program for other educators as well. The Senate, for its part, it sets aside $500 million for teachers and the House $650 million, but neither has a bonus program. Both also are looking to give school districts more authority to increase salaries for veteran teachers, while DeSantis wanted only to really increase the base pay, mostly for starting teachers. He wanted to bring it up to $47,500 a year, which would have made it the second highest in the nation. But the House and Senate have they've thrown in another thing, too. They have dueling pay raises for state workers. Now, that's something that the governor sidestepped mostly in his budget proposal. Getting past the budget, another unknown, you've mentioned E-Verify. That's something that, it may be getting even more potential focus right now after President Trump in his State of the Union address this week seemed to come down very heavy against sanctuary cities and reiterated his call for building a wall and generally, hammered the issue of immigration. But there's not a lot of support in the House and Senate for DeSantis's push to require all businesses in Florida to use this federal E-Verify database.
Yeah, John, that to me is one of the more interesting issues, because it does seem like DeSantis is going to get some version of his teacher pay increase, this abortion bill that you're covering today in the Senate, the parental consent bill looks like it's going to pass. But E-Verify, there's a big question mark there. I mean, there's some powerful interests in the business community that don't want to see that. But the Republican base really does want to see that. Joe Gruters, the Republican Party chairman in Florida, even pushed to have the party officially push through a resolution saying that the party in Florida endorses E-Verify for all businesses in the state, which is pretty interesting because Gruters is a member of the Florida Senate as well, and Senate leaders have sort of resisted enacting this blanket E-Verify proposal. The governor doesn't seem to be giving up on this, but does that seem like the most questionable element of his agenda in terms of what's likely to pass?
Yeah, it could well be, as far as maybe getting out of the session with not much at all in the end. Everything else, as you mentioned, it looks like he's going to get some version of it. But E-Verify is a question. And you got to wonder, too, is this all just political theater? Is this something that Republican leaders can point to, this Republican leaders being basically DeSantis and maybe President Trump, saying that, they tried their darndest to get E-Verify in the state, but, blame it on, the faceless legislature, that type of thing. So, the pay raises are also an interesting dynamic, because here you have Republicans giving money to two big Democratic constituencies, state workers and teachers. Republican leaders would really like to quiet any criticism from those groups, that recurring claim that Republicans don't care about teachers or state workers. I mean, here's a way maybe to kind of soften that by giving them some money. But the money differences between these the House and Senate also could create, I think, some tension between these two Democratic allied groups. Republican leaders love to throw hand grenades into some of these heavy union-dominated organizations, and whoever does better with raises You know, that may cause some envy and some sparks with the other organization. You know, other high profile clashes are still to come. You know, that's the Senate puts $125 million into Florida Forever. That's the big environmental land buying program that the House only wants to put $20 million behind. That's a prominent issue with environmentalists who always want to see solid funding for that program. The House also siphons off $240 million from the state's Affordable Housing Trust Fund, using it in other programs, while the Senate would spend the full $387 million that's in that fund on housing. That's another embattled program every year. And then lastly, you have Visit Florida. That's the state's tourism marketing arm. That's going to get $50 million from the Senate, and that's a move backed by DeSantis. But the House right now is sticking by its no funding for Visit Florida, and they want to see that agency disappear on June 30th.
Well, plenty left unsettled here as we go into the second half of the legislative session. So I know you're going to be really busy, John. But one issue that's not getting much attention in the legislature right now is climate change. Republicans control the legislature and the governor's mansion, but they've largely ignored climate change over the last decade. Governor Ron DeSantis has departed from that position a little bit and is talking about addressing some of the impacts of warmer temperatures like sea level rise. DeSantis also appointed a chief science officer to help advise him on environmental issues, including climate change, and a chief resiliency officer to start preparing the state for sea level rise. There's also a bill moving through the legislature right now that would establish a resiliency office within the governor's office to tackle these issues. But environmental advocates really, they want to see the state go a lot further. They're happy that there's some movement, but they think that it's nowhere near enough. I caught up with the state's chief science officer, Thomas Frazier, the first person to ever hold that job, and saw him during an appearance in Sarasota this week. And I asked him about the issue of curbing carbon emissions that contribute to global warming. Here's what he had to say.
On the carbon side, though, if the governor asks you, what does the science say on this? I mean, what would you tell him?
I mean, I have congressional testimony that says, hey, you know, climate change is real, right?
Right.
And humans are responsible for it. And ultimately, we're going to have to reduce carbon emissions, right, to reduce warming. And it's effects, right? And those effects are broader than just sea level rise. You know,
right.
We have increased ocean temperatures that are affecting in a negative way our coral reef resources. That would be another example.
So there you have a member of the DeSantis administration saying climate change is real, humans are causing it, and we have to reduce carbon emissions. For a lot of people, that just sounds like, yes, that's what people should be saying. That's what the scientists are saying. But that's not really what we've heard out of Republican administrations in Florida over the last decade here. You even go to President Donald Trump had a rally recently, Rush Limbaugh was there, and Limbaugh said at the rally that climate change is a hoax. Don't believe it. You know, Limbaugh recently got the Presidential Medal of Freedom during Trump's State of the Union speech. So that just sort of tells you that there's a lot of people within the GOP that are still very skeptical of climate change. And it's not a high priority issue for a lot of Republicans, but it's really interesting, John, to see somebody in the governor's mansion in Florida, not the governor's mansion, but in the executive branch in Florida, saying all these things, whether or not DeSantis listens to him. Do you think it's notable to have somebody in the administration talking like this?
Oh, sure. It's quite a difference a long way from the climate change shunning Rick Scott, who preceded DeSantis as governor the past 8 years. Presumably, some of Frazier's comments are a reflection of how his boss, DeSantis, feels. But, environmentalists also want to see more from DeSantis. This week, the House moved to take the state's energy office away from Democratic Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried, and they want to give it to the Department of Environmental Protection, which is under DeSantis. Supporters were saying, simply, well, it's just policy. You know, this is a better place for it, and the governor is a reliable environmental partner. But Fried is a Democrat and may be more agreeable with groups that want to see statewide goals for greenhouse gas reduction, for example. So far, DeSantis has been silent on that issue. At this point, it's hard to say that this office transfer will take place. But politically, it may be a way for Republicans to try to keep Fried from doing something to enhance her environmental credibility and kind of keep DeSantis in charge of all things climate change, you know, when it comes to how the state is reacting to it. And as I mentioned, so far, DeSantis is not really that far out there on that issue, although he has done a couple of high profile things like appoint these two staff officers.
Right. It has been relatively modest stuff that he's done. But to have people in your administration talking like this, I mean, as you said, under Rick Scott, there was some reporting that people weren't even allowed to say the words climate change. So it does seem like a change. Antonio, what do you think?
Yeah, I think what you're seeing is a reflection of a generational gap, even within the Republican Party. You've got Rick Scott, the president, Rush Limbaugh, the traditional old guard, quote unquote, or literally of the party. But then you have a lot of younger voices. You know, keep in mind, DeSantis is 40 years old. Matt Gaetz, another one who has warned Republicans about the political dangers and perils, not to mention the environmental and ecological and economic consequences of ignoring this issue.
So Matt Gaetz, one of the most conservative lawmakers probably in the country, and also one of the staunchest Trump defenders, but a very big believer in climate change.
Yeah, and I think so. You're seeing a divide. I think it's a generational gap that younger Republicans see what's coming. And I think they understand the reality of this, both from an environmental standpoint, but from a political and economic standpoint as well. Whereas perhaps maybe some of the old guard in the Republican Party, even among the Tea Party revolt and the non-traditional, non-establishment Republicans, don't take it as seriously. But and you're going to see this continue to play out, this generational gap in the party as we keep going forward.
I agree. And I don't think there's much political risk for DeSantis to have people in his administration who are talking about this. But it starts to maybe put a little bit of pressure on him to say, well, if you have people who are your advisors saying this, why aren't you doing anything about it? And so we'll see. We'll see if he, continues to put people, in important spots who are saying these things, because it does put a little bit of pressure on him to actually take some action. Well, we're going to move on to some number picking. Antonio, you had the lowest there with 0.2%. You want to tell us about that?
Yeah, that 0.2% is the margin of victory last year, well, actually in 2018, in the Rick Scott, Bill Nelson Senate race. And the reason I'm bringing that up right now is that you look at the impeachment trial in the Senate this year, that ended yesterday, and you look at the fact that the Senate makeup right now is 53 Republicans to 47 Democrats. Well, before the 2018 elections, it was 51-49, and part of that margin was the race that Bill Nelson lost to Rick Scott by just 10,033 votes. And you think how different this impeachment trial would have gone if the margin had been 51-49 as it was before the 2018 elections. No. You could say the same thing about the U.S. House. If the Democrats at the blue wave of 2018 had not flipped the U.S. House, this issue would never even have gotten to an impeachment. So my point is not to argue impeachment one way or the other, but just to remind people that elections matter and your vote matters. You know, history will show that President Trump was impeached. History will also show that President Trump was acquitted. And the reason that happened, regardless what the history shows, the reason even that came to happen was because of the 2018 election and the results thereof. So if you're unhappy that he got impeached and you're unhappy that he got acquitted, well, you have a say in November when you go to the polls. So, you know, February 18th is your first shot to change your voter register, your deadline for any voter registration changes or to register for the primary. And then you've got another election in November. That's how we should settle these issues.
Yeah, it's a really good point. I mean, that election, that Senate election in Florida where Rick Scott beat Bill Nelson, it wouldn't have changed the impeachment outcome. They would have had to get a lot more votes to the removal to convict him at the trial. But, it might have resulted in calling witnesses. John Bolton put more pressure on folks like Susan Collins for that. So it definitely could have changed the course of the trial for sure.
No, look, yeah, you're right. It would not have probably changed the unlikely would have changed the acquittal vote. You're not going to get to 2/3, but the trial itself would have been very different.
Yeah, definitely. John, you had a 2 there. You want to tell us about that?
Yeah, Zach, this is kind of a post-Iowa number pick. 2 in this case is where Florida stands in the list of delegate-rich states that are still left on the board after the March 3rd Super Tuesday primary. Now, that's when about 1/3 of the total delegate allocation will be handed out in 14 states, including big ones like Texas and California. But Florida's March 17th presidential primary will have the second largest number of delegates still available on the primary calendar. Florida is going to have 219 pledged delegates up for grabs that day. That's trailing only New York's 274. New York, their primary isn't until April 28th, so that's very far off, with the feeling by then that maybe a clear runner may, clear front runner, I should say, may have emerged by that point. But Florida in a few weeks, may still be important, as we've pointed out before on this podcast. The 1,990 pledged delegates are needed to win the Democratic nomination. And, for all the focus on poor Iowa, for all its mess ups, that only counts for 41 delegates.
Yeah, Florida is definitely a much bigger prize, that's for sure. Well, my number is 145,000. That's the number of petition signatures that supporters of an assault weapons ban were able to collect as they sought to get the constitutional amendment on the Florida ballot in 2020. And that is well short of the 766,200 that they needed to get by February 1st to get on the ballot. That means voters won't get a chance to weigh in on the issue this year. And that's another big setback for the gun control movement in a state that has been the epicenter of this issue since the shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in 2018. Whatever momentum the movement had after Parkland seems to have faded a little bit here. The only other opportunity to regulate guns emerged this year in the Florida Senate, where GOP leaders have supported universal background checks. But Governor Ron DeSantis and Republicans in the House are very, very skeptical of that. And that background check bill does not appear like it's going anywhere. And I think the broader movement that has emerged out of Parkland appears to have stalled a little bit, at least here in Florida. That wraps up another episode of Inside Florida Politics. I want to thank our audio production team of Thomas Cordy and Joseph Rosano. And thanks to all of you for listening. We're out of here.